Hello, I'm James Kamara-Sami. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Tuesday, the 12th of November. After the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, resigns over his handling of a child abuse scandal, we ask what it means for the Church of England, for abuse survivors and for safeguarding practices in the church. We also look ahead to the succession, the process, the personalities and the challenges facing whoever gets the role. Also, a major shake-up in the post office, the winner of the Man Booker Prize revealed. We get another perspective on the assisted dying bill and hear from the General Director of Amsterdam's Rijksmuseum on why he's allowing visitors to watch Rembrandt's The Night Watch being restored. You're listening to The World Tonight with James Kamara-Sami. If he had stayed in post until his 70th birthday in January 2026, Justin Welby would have entered the history books as the longest-serving Archbishop of Canterbury in half a century. Instead, at the end of his time as the Church of England senior cleric, the symbolic head of the worldwide Anglican Communion, will have a rather more inglorious chapter. 5 days after the publication of a report that heavily criticised his handling of a serial child abuser linked to the Church of England, Justin Welby bowed to growing pressure from within and outside the church and resigned today. In a statement, he referred to his failure to report John Smythe's abuse of more than 100 boys and young men when he became aware of it more than a decade ago. Justin Welby wrote that he must take personal and institutional responsibility for the long and re-traumatising period between 2013 and 2024. He added that he was informed in 2013 that the police had been notified, but, quote, I believed wrongly that an appropriate resolution would follow. Today, Stephen Cottrell, the Archbishop of York, reflected on that decision.
Today is a day of sadness. You know, I'm sad for him. I'm sad for our church. I'm desperately sad for the people who've been hurt and abused because of the church's failings and by people who were acting in the name of Christ. It's a shameful thing. But I believe his exercise of responsibility in this is a sign for all of us to accept our own responsibilities.
And this is what the Prime Minister said about the scandal earlier in the day.
You know, it's a matter in the end for the church, but I'm not going to shy away from the fact that saying these are horrific allegations and that my thoughts are with the victims in relation to it. I think that's very important.
Well, Madeline Davis is senior reporter at the Church Times, and she's been covering the John Smythe abuse scandal since 2017. She's on the line. Good evening, Madeline.
Good evening.
First of all, today, just take us through what happened and how we reached this point.
So I guess since publication of the Macon Review, which looked at John Smythe's review, there were quite quickly calls for the Archbishop of Canterbury to resign. And so there's kind of been a growing chorus of those calls in recent days. He initially said that he decided, having taken advice from senior colleagues, that he would not be resigning. And the reason for that was that he said that he hadn't learned of the abuse until 2013, at which point he thought that appropriate action was being taken. Today, obviously, he announced that he decided that he would resign. That followed an intervention from one of the bishops, the Bishop of Newcastle, who said that his position was untenable, and obviously comments by the Prime Minister earlier today as well.
Just put this into context. Have we seen anything like this before in modern times?
So the review said that it concludes that John Smythe was the most prolific serial abuser connected to the Church of England. So that gives you an idea of the gravity of the abuse. We've covered many cases of terrible abuse in the church. But I think the fact that this occurred over so many decades and also across three countries, because John Smythe moved to Africa after leaving the UK, that gives you an idea of the scale of the abuse that was perpetrated and covered up for so long.
And finally, the fact that the Archbishop of Canterbury has resigned, if you can put that into context.
Yes, so I suppose people felt there was an inevitability almost in recent days as the calls grew, but it certainly wasn't you know, prior to this, there was an expectation that he would remain in post until his retirement age. There was actually a poll by the Times newspaper which suggested that he was popular with clergy. He had a very good profile, I think, nationally, really, and publicly through some very high profile media interviews. I think he had that popularity there. It's really this that has prompted the resignation, and that has, you know, the abuse scandal has just caused such horror, I think.
Madeline, thanks very much. Madeline Davis, senior reporter at the Church Times. Do stay with us, though, Madeline. We want to come back to you in a moment, but we're going to turn now to the issue of safeguarding. Dr. Jamie Harrison is chair of the House of Laity on the Church of England Synod, also director of Safe Spaces. It's a charity that helps survivors of abuse in the church. And I asked him how damaging the events that have led to Justin Welby's resignation have been for the church.
Well, I think the first thing to say, I've got a lot of time for the Archbishop. I've known him on and off for quite a few years. He's a good man. But obviously, he's reached a point where he feels he's getting in the way of the future safeguarding programme of the church. So inevitably, there's going to be damage from that. And we need to face up to that and get better at it, as we've been trying to do. But unfortunately, we've not been going perhaps as quickly as we should have done.
So what needs to happen differently?
Well, we can take a deep breath. We can reflect. We've been apologising for quite some time now about failures. We need to be different. I think there needs to be some sort of significant change. We have had a review by Alexis Jay, who came up with recommendations for much greater independency of our safeguarding. And I'm on the group that is trying to implement what Alexis Jay began for us through her report, to see greater independence, greater transparency, and ultimately greater trustworthiness.
Could you perhaps expand on that? What are you trying to do?
Our very kind survivors who work with us, amazingly, who have been through the mill with the church, still want to work with us and say, you've got to be more open, you've got to be much clearer, you've got to move away from being so self-absorbed, perhaps, and also protecting your own reputation. There's got to be a sea change, in my view, about how we think about investigating and responding to the needs and concerns of victims and survivors.
Can this then be a moment, given how this has culminated in the unprecedented resignation of the Archbishop of Canterbury, when the church focuses on this and real lessons are learned?
Or the other way around is, if we don't do it now, when are we going to do it? And there's a point at which you run out of road, don't you? If we don't change now, we're not going to change.
You say that the Archbishop is a good man, but has he set back the church in its broader mission?
I don't know is a simple answer. I mean, yes, we are in a difficult place. And I think you'd have to say, why would you trust us?
Dr. Jamie Harrison, a director of Safe Spaces, a charity that helps survivors of abuse in the church. We're going to turn now to someone who also advocates for survivors. We heard from him on Friday's programme, the journalist and broadcaster Andrew Greystone. He investigated John Smythe and advocates for the survivors of his abuse. And he's back with us. Andrew, thanks for coming in. First of all, were you surprised at this decision by the Archbishop of Canterbury?
No, I think it was inevitable. And the surprise, if you like, is that it didn't happen sooner, given that nothing that was in last week's report, nothing substantive, wasn't known some years ago. So there is a sense of the Archbishop and the others hanging on over the last few years. But if they think that this one action is going to clear the decks, either in relation to the abuse of John Smythe or in relation to the future of safeguarding within the Church of England, that would be a big mistake. I noted that Dr. Jamie Harrison said that the church was looking towards implementing Professor Jay's recommendations for more independence in safeguarding. That isn't what Professor Jay said. She said that there should be full independence in safeguarding in the Church of England. Not just let's let a little bit of light in, but let's take the responsibility for safeguarding failures out of the hands of the church and place it with independent experts.
What about those who have suffered from those failures? Have you been able to speak to any of the survivors?
Oh, absolutely. I've spoken to a number of Smythe survivors today, and I speak on a daily basis with others who have been hurt in the life of the church. And they always say, always, that the way that the church has treated them is as bad or sometimes worse than the original abuse.
And those you've spoken to today, what have they made of Justin Welby's resignation?
On the whole, they welcome the resignation, having been severely personally let down by him. But there is a strong sense that, on the one hand, Justin Welby isn't the only bishop who knew, and so others also ought to take responsibility. And on the other hand, this doesn't fix the problem of safeguarding in the Church of England. There's a much more fundamental cultural change that is needed in order to make the church a safer place, and the church hierarchy is fiercely resistant to that kind of change.
Andrew, many thanks for coming in. Andrew Greystone there, who advocates for the survivors of John Smythe's abuse. We're going to turn to some of the issues that Andrew has raised in a moment, but let's look ahead to this question of the succession. Madeline Davis from the Church Times is still with us. Madeline, just talk us through, if you can, what happens now? How does the church go about finding the next Archbishop of Canterbury?
So the Archbishop has announced the decision to retire, but his statement also refers to a number of obligations which he still has to fulfil. So technically, we would say that there's still not a vacancy. There's an expectation the Archbishop of York in the coming months will kind of fulfil his role, and there will be, and then this sort of official search for a successor will begin. That will take many months and takes the form of the Crown Nominations Commission, which is a body that represents the Church of England. It will have lay people, it will have clergy, it will have representatives from the Global Anglican Communion on it, and they will meet to discern who this successor should be. It'll also have a chairperson who's appointed by Downing Street, which kind of acknowledges that we have an established church. You know, there's that connection between church and state. So it will be many months before we have a successor to the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Madeline, thank you very much for that briefing. Madeline Davis from the Church Times. Well, let's discuss that process in a bit more detail and consider the challenges that the church faces following Justin Welby's decision to resign. We're joined by the Right Reverend Rose Hudson-Wilkin, Bishop of Dover, and John Milbank, a theologian and emeritus professor of philosophy at the University of Nottingham. Good evening to both of you.
Good evening.
Hello, good evening.
Bishop Rose, if I may call you that, what is your thoughts, first of all, on the decision by the Archbishop of Canterbury today?
I think what I want to begin by saying is how deeply shocked and saddened I am to have learned of the incidents of abuse that survivors have suffered in the past with regards to the perpetrator that this report names. With regards to the Archbishop, I'm also saddened that it has led to this. And the reason why I'm sad that it has led to this is that I believe with all the effort, this particular Archbishop has contributed to the church moving to a better place when it comes to safeguarding. And so, you know, if what happened back then were to have happened today, I am in no doubt that I too would be saying, yes, you cannot stay in that role. I don't know the circumstances around how he was told, when he was told, or anything like that. But I just want to say my point on this whole thing is, if we're really wanting to see change, then we cannot just be calling for resignations.
Well,
it has to be more than that.
Well, perhaps we might explore that in a bit. But John Milbank, perhaps before we get on to that, can you just explain how this process is going to work in terms of choosing the next Archbishop of Canterbury? We've heard a briefing there from Madeline, but do people lobby for the position? What happens?
Well, not officially, but it's all very, very arcane. But I think one can imagine in the background, there's going to be all sorts of lobbying and all sorts of arguments, because we've got this safeguarding issue, we've got the argument about parishes, we've got the argument about gay sexuality, the argument about whether the Archbishop should be focusing more on England rather than on the global Anglican Communion, about whether there's too much centralisation. After all, Welby was brought in as an executive and he suffered an executive death. Don't we now need a much more spiritual and interpersonal kind of leader? I think all those issues are going to be very hotly contested.
Bishop Rose, what sort of leader do you think the church needs? What sort of profile?
I think we need spiritual leaders who are compassionate, who are faithful, who are focused around the gospel. And I have seen that in the Archbishop of Canterbury. And I have seen that in the Archbishop that we have of York as well. So, and I've seen someone, you know, during COVID, this was the Archbishop who was at the bedside of the sick and the dying on a regular basis at his local hospital. So this is someone who does know, you know, he may have been an oil executive and he may be seen in that ilk, but this is somebody who I have worked with and who I have seen on the ground level, who is extremely pastoral.
But in terms of who succeeds him, those issues raised by John Milbank about whether someone needs to concentrate more on the Church of England and less on the wider worldwide Anglican Communion, where do you stand on that, for example?
I believe that it's got to be a real balance, because the Anglican Communion is worldwide and we are part of a worldwide family. And in a family, we don't just say, I am concentrating on me and my 2.2 children. You know, we say we are with the family, and that means the extended family. We're going to have to find a way of doing that. We're going to have to find a way of working better as a family here in the United Kingdom as well, because that's what we have not been doing very well.
John Milbank, if I can return to you, Bishop Rose, I'm sure would be too modest or wouldn't want to talk about her own chances of this, but
oh, absolutely not.
But
absolutely
let me ask you, John, who are the people being considered? Do you have any sense?
Oh, I have absolutely very little sense. I think the Bishop of Norwich has been named, the Bishop of Chelmsford, Bishop of Leicester. But what I would say is I think there is going to be a big debate now about Justin Welby's legacy and his whole kind of managerialist way of doing things. And most significantly, he does seem to have systematically tried to undermine the existing parish structure in favour of so-called fresh expressions, which are much more gathered and sectarian, specifically sort of evangelical communities. And that's somehow seen by many people as betraying the mission of the church to the whole people of England. The pastoral responsibility for places and everybody in that place, including people who may be more loosely attached to the church. And I think that the fact that this has all happened and that Welby was linked to perhaps to Paula Venables and the post office scandal as well is going to call into question his entire approach.
Sure.
And I think one could even say that, you know, something like the safeguarding scandal is somehow linked to the prevalence of half-belief. You know, the church becomes a cover for different cults, you know, cults of perversity, precisely because of a half-belief and
John,
a lack of focus on Christianity and, the Christian spiritual mission.
I'm
so
afraid
I think people are going to see that all these things are joined up and that we need to restore money and priests to
John
parishes.
Milbank, I'm so sorry.
Theological
I'm afraid
education.
We have to. I'm afraid we have to wrap this up.
John, if we're going to overcome the kind of mess we are now in.
John Milbank, Emeritus Professor at the Department of Theology, Religious Studies at the University of Nottingham, and Rose Hudson Wilkin, Bishop of Dover. Thanks very much. John Milbank referring there to the post office controversy. And, well, there's news of a major shake-up at the post office expected tomorrow. Our business correspondent, Emma Simpson, has a story, and she's with me in the studio. Now, Emma, what have you found out?
Well, of course, just to remind you, if you need reminding, this is a business in crisis dealing with the fallout from the Horizon IT scandal. So it has a new chairman, Nigel Railton, and he's been doing a strategic review to transform the business and try and put it on a more sustainable financial footing. So he's going to be outlining his plans tomorrow. We understand it's going to lead to hundreds of job losses at head office. It also has 115 Crown offices, which are at risk of closure. Now, these are directly managed and owned by the post office, and generally, these are the bigger branches in city centres, and they are loss-making, and I'm told that that's not sustainable. So they're going to be looking at options for these branches, whether the post office can possibly find franchise partners to run them instead. And more than 1,200 staff work in these branches. And I think in a nutshell, what this plan is about is slimming down the centre and trying to put more money into the pockets of the independent sub-postmasters, the self-employed branch managers, who, of course, we've been hearing so much about this year, and many of them are struggling to make enough money. So this is being billed, if you like, as a new deal for them to strengthen the branch network. But, of course, it sounds as if it's going to mean significant changes for the post office's directly employed staff. Of course, I think there's going to be a lot of consultation on this, and it's going to cost a lot to do. So the government said tonight it was an active discussion with Nigel Railton on his plans, and that post offices are an integral part of the communities they serve. And of course, just to remind you, the taxpayer, us, we own it. It's a public asset.
Emma, many thanks. Our business correspondent Emma Simpson there. Now, in the last hour, the Booker Prize judges have announced this year's winner.
I am profoundly honoured to announce that the winner of the Booker Prize 2024 is Samantha Harvey for Orbital. Thank you.
The six judges voted unanimously for Samantha Harvey's Orbital. As you heard, it's a novel that follows six astronauts aboard the International Space Station over 24 hours. This was the author's reaction.
I was not expecting that. We were told that we weren't allowed to swear in our speech. So there goes my speech. It was just one swear word 150 times.
Well, Alex Clark is co-host of the Graham Norton Book Club podcast and joins me now. No swearing, I hope, from you, Alex. And were you surprised?
I guess I was, in the sense that you really can never call out where a jury is going to go. And times when before I've thought, oh, I know the book that really stands out here, I've not been right. So I decided not. I hedged my bets internally, as it were.
Very wise. Well, tell us about Orbital. What do we need to know?
Well, as you said there, it's the story of or story is perhaps it's an observation, a meditation in a way, of a day in the life of the six astronauts on board the International Space Station, which already has a kind of elegiac sort of feel to it, because that is, you know, something that's going to be decommissioned in the relatively near future. And I believe that's one of the reasons that Samantha Harvey wanted to write about it, that it had this sense of a project of kind of great technological and international cooperation that then would involve real people going and living side by side in this extraordinarily artificial and contrived environment. And that's what she wanted to write about.
And how did she do it? How did she write about that?
Well, I think on a really technical sort of, you know, mundane level, she actually sat watching the NASA feed for really quite a long time. I think it was a project that started life in lockdown when we were looking to find views into other worlds. But I guess one of the things that she had to confront in putting together this narrative was, how do you deal with time? Time is always an issue in the novel and in short stories. How do you represent the passage of time? A really difficult thing to do when you have the day coming at you 16 times in what we would call a day. So time expanded and contracted, and that was what she played with, I think.
A worthy winner?
I think so. I'm thrilled for her. And I should say I'm just so thrilled. This is her fifth novel. She's a writer of such talent and, I think, incredible perspicacity. And a wider audience, I hope, awaits her.
I'm sure it does. Alex Clark, co-host of the Graham Norton Book Club podcast there on Samantha Harvey and her novel Orbital, which has won the Booker Prize. Now, as we came on air last night, the details of the new assisted dying bill were just coming to light. And as its title suggests, if passed into law, the Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill would allow terminally ill adults with less than 6 months to live to get medical help to end their own life. They would need to express a clear, settled and informed wish at every stage of the process without coercion and pressure. Today, Keir Starmer underlined that MPs would also be making an unshackled choice in what will be a free vote on a private member's bill.
I will not be putting pressure on any MP to vote one way or the other. I personally will study the details of the bill which has now been published today, because safeguards have always been extremely important to me and were an essential part of the guidelines that I myself drew up when I was chief prosecutor.
Let's speak to our political correspondent, Hannah Miller. So, Hannah, 24 hours on from its publication, what sort of reaction are you picking up from MPs when it comes to this bill?
I mean, at this point, we certainly don't know how this vote is going to go. There are 650 MPs. They can each do what they want. There's no party whip, and we only have indications at the moment from about a third of them. What we do have looks pretty split. There are those in favour who really think that the public mood has shifted since there was last a vote on this in 2015. There are then those who will never vote for this, who fundamentally disagree, perhaps not exclusively, but perhaps on religious grounds. Some like Ed Davey, who said that he won't be voting for it because he worries that terminally ill people might feel under pressure to take their own lives, even if they never actually voice that themselves. It might still influence their decision. Then I think what you really pick up in Parliament at the moment is a lot of undecideds, some persuaded by the fact that this bill is very limited in terms of who it applies to, others less convinced in terms of the practicalities of it. How would people get appointments with the doctors? Would it clog up the courts? What would it do to the state of palliative care? Would it be better to focus on improving that first? There's also a question about the timing, which I've heard people discuss, and in some ways it's a political question as well. Ministers have been saying that the NHS is broken, so is now really the right time to go ahead with this when public services are struggling? There are a lot of conversations going on. I think going ahead with this, many MPs are aware it would potentially be the biggest decision that some of them will make, and a lot of them are undecided.
Hannah, many thanks. Our political correspondent, Hannah Miller there. Well, we've been having a few conversations about the bill on the programme in the lead up to it being published. We've heard a variety of viewpoints. We've spoken to the actor Liz Carr, head of the Roman Catholic Church in England and Wales, Archbishop Vincent Nichols, both of them opposed to the idea of assisted dying entering the statute books. We've also heard from the former head of the Oregon Hospice Association, Anne Jackson. She spoke up for her US state's highly restricted model of assisted dying. Well, this evening, we're going to hear from someone who thinks the proposed bill doesn't go far enough. 70-year-old Alex Pandolfo is a former university lecturer. He was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease in 2015, and 2 years later, he was accepted into a centre for assisted dying in Switzerland. He says he plans to travel there before his symptoms mean he no longer has the mental capacity to take an end-of-life decision. And I asked Alex how his views on assisted dying had been shaped.
I've been watching my father, who had multiple systems atrophy, and then for the last 5 years of his life had related dementia. And then following that, after my diagnosis, my mum suffered with vascular dementia for a long time. So I'd seen them both suffer really, really badly. And I had an idea of what could be facing me.
And once you had made that choice that you would sign up to an assisted dying clinic, what did that change for you?
It changed my life completely. I'd been given a dreadful prognosis of something like, I think it was 3 to 4 years to live. Although I could live up to 11 years, but for the best part of that, I would need constant care. So the future was daunting. And my thoughts were consumed with how I would end up, what could happen to me. I'd made the decision that I would apply to Life Circle in Switzerland, and if it was unsuccessful, that I would commit suicide in 2017, so I would avoid what was going on. Thankfully, I got the green light, and like many other people, up to now, I haven't needed the assisted death, but I've had it there, and it transformed my life. Like I said, the majority of people are the same. They apply for it, but they don't necessarily go through with it, but they're able to live a happy and fulfilling life for what's left of their lives.
So the last 7 years, once you got the green light, well, what have they been like?
The last 7 years have been good. There's ups and downs, but some of that could be due to the diagnosis. Some of it could be due to the fact that I'm getting old. I'm not suicidal. I want to live, but I want to live well.
What do you think then of the bill that is being proposed, the assisted dying bill? Someone like you, of course, would not be able to benefit from it, would you?
The fact that it's being discussed and hopefully the bill will go through, it is a step forward, and it's a tremendous step forward for people who qualify. Unfortunately, the majority of people who travel to Switzerland for assisted death wouldn't qualify under this legislation.
Yes, quite. It's only for terminally ill adults. Do you think, is this a missed opportunity then?
I like to say, I hope that it's a law that will get passed as it is, and that we're able to develop that law. I think it needs to be more inclusive and look after people, not only who are suffering for the last 6 months, but people who could be suffering for years and years with non-curable, non-treatable, degenerative conditions.
But a lot of people are concerned about just that eventuality, aren't they? Do you understand those concerns?
No, I don't. What I don't understand is the term that's generally used, the term slippery slope. Assisted dying, where that's been expanded, it's developed a policy. That's not a slippery slope. A slippery slope would be if it deviates from its original aims or perspective or expectations.
Given that this bill, if it becomes law, as it stands now, would not apply to you, how will you take that decision about possibly going to Switzerland?
I suppose I would have to assess when things deteriorate and they're having an impact, where they're perhaps putting me at risk, or I'm putting other people at risk. That is the time I'd need to go. The unfortunate thing about that, because it's not legal in this country, people like myself never know when the right time is.
Alex Pandolfo. And do please keep sending us your comments and experiences on this issue. We'll aim to share as many as we can on air to help to inform the debate. You can email world.tonight@bbc.co.uk. You can use WhatsApp. The number is 03700 100444. Or you can send a text on 84844. But do bear in mind your phone service provider may charge for that. Now, each year, more than 2 million people see Rembrandt's masterpiece, The Night Watch, at Amsterdam's Rijksmuseum. From today, that experience has an extra layer. Visitors aren't just seeing the great Golden Age painting of a militia, but also its biggest ever restoration project, which is being carried out in public inside a specially designed glass box. Taco Dibitz is the Rijksmuseum's general director.
Well, The Night Watch is Rembrandt's most ambitious work. It's about 4 yards in width. It depicts 36 men who were the men who protected the city of Amsterdam during the war against Spain in the 17th century. And it's a painting with which Rembrandt wanted the viewer to feel respect and awe. But the special thing about it is that Rembrandt really revolutionized the way we look at people. He depicts people, in a sense, the bare truth, the raw truth. He doesn't depict his sitters more beautiful than they are. He depicts them as they are. And he's a master in depicting their emotions and their humanity, you could say. And in that sense, it's really a tribute to humanity.
And now you are showing viewers the truth, if you like, of how a painting is restored?
We felt it's a painting which has such fame that it really belongs to everyone. And we're a public institution, and we feel that everyone has the right to see what we actually do with the Night Watch. It was first attacked by somebody with a knife, and then it was attacked by somebody who tried to spray acid on it. So now slowly, with all the conservation that happened afterwards, taking off the varnish layers and taking off all the overpaint, you will see the naked truth, and you will actually get as close to Rembrandt's paint as you can get into the life of this painting.
What is it going to be like for those doing this painstaking, meticulous work in full view of the viewing public, do you think?
Well, I asked today one of the conservators, and she said, once you turn around away from the public and facing the painting, you get in such a focused, concentrated state that you can do your work and the rest kind of disappears.
And the audience, the viewing public, what do you think they will get out of seeing, if you like, behind the scenes?
Well, very personally for me, I was there as a child. When I was 7, I saw the conservation after the attack, the knife attack. And you could see the painting and how it was this different stages of the conservation. And I've never forgotten that. It gives you a once-in-a-lifetime experience to kind of look into the kitchen, into the lab of the restorer, but also to see the naked truth of the painting.
To end with the painting itself, what are you hoping will be restored? What is it that has faded away over the years? What is it that you are hoping will return?
Well, the varnish had yellowed, but had also become matte in certain areas. And Rembrandt is such a master at creating depth with light and dark contrast. And when it was restored in the 1970s, they did it in less than 4 months. So they had to work very fast, often overpainting original paint by Rembrandt. So we will also be able to take that overpaint off and to really be certain that all the original paint of Rembrandt will be visible. And that will make the picture far more legible. And really, I think it will be magic to see it again.
Taco Dibitz, the General Director of the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. A bit of breaking news tonight. The US President-elect Donald Trump has appointed Stephen C. Witkoff to be special envoy to the Middle East. He's a real estate investor and a donor to the Trump campaign, not known to have any diplomatic experience. But in a statement, the Trump team says Steve will be an unrelenting voice for peace and make us all proud. Our main headline tonight, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, has resigned after mounting pressure over a report that revealed the Church of England had concealed 50 years of child abuse. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. I'll be back tomorrow at 10. But for now, from all of us here, good night.